Thanks, Lars. Thanks for coming. This is about a 20-minute presentation, and it's going to be a little bit provocative and hopefully a little bit funny, and it's intended to spark debate and conversation. So when it's done, I'll put the screen up and go to the blackboard, and at that point, we can talk about some of the problems and the solutions to these problems. To start, you know, in several sessions last week, the Peanut Gallery asked the speaker towards the start of their talks, you know, why are we here today? Well, you're here today because of me, and that does not necessarily make me a Platonist, but perhaps a strange attractor. We are, however, here to discuss what I call media logic, which works because our brains are flawed, or so say professional researchers in the field. And we will talk about how to explain science to people who watch 5 hours of television every day. But first, a word from our sponsor. It all began about 2 billion years ago. That's me on the left, the altruistic chronoflagellate who was investigating potential defectors. I was, in fact, part of the first journalist. But that's a very long story, so let's fast forward to the present. Full disclosure, I have no formal science training and was an artist for many years. In fact, I still am. But both my parents were journalists, and so a combination of genetic propensities and the increasingly scurvy environments in which I found myself eventually expressed my inner investigative reporter. The question is whether or not becoming a science writer was in my genes, or perhaps it was purely stochastic. Here's what happened. I was a staff writer for an alternative weekly, SF Weekly in San Francisco, when a good friend of mine moved to California and took a position as a physicist at Stanford and told me about M theory, which is, you know, string theory. So I wrote a little story for the general audience on M theory and got interested in physics and asked my friend, what can I write about next, you know? And he goes, well, there's this guy, Hugh Everett, who invented this theory of multiple universes. That might go over. So we Googled him, and this guy in Kostroma, Russia, named Eugene Shaotsev, had spent a good deal of his winters over his own Wang computer researching online everything he could find out about Hugh Everett. But he couldn't leave Kostroma. So he actually turned his project over to me, and I learned that this fellow Everett, who's been fairly influential in physics over the years in terms of foundational questions, had a son who was a rock singer, famous in his own world, leads a band called The Eels, named Mark Everett. And so I talked to Mark and pitched a story to Rolling Stone about the rock singer with the weird dad. And the editor there said, well, you know, our people don't really care about physics at all. So then I went to, like, you know, Harper's and New Yorkers everywhere. Everybody's like, cool story, but, you know, nobody really wants to read about physics. And so as a desperation, I went to Scientific American, and they said, yeah, lose the rock singer and write about the dad. So I said, no, you want to keep the rock singer, because that's how you're going to get all these other people to read about the dad, right? So they agreed, and we kept the rock singer and did the article. And then one thing led to another. The BBC ended up making a little documentary that I participated in that's on Nova a lot, called Parallel Worlds, Parallel Lives, where the rock singer goes to find out what happened to his dad. And then I discovered a whole bunch of papers in the rock singer's basement, like the original draft of the dad's controversial theory and correspondence with Niels Bohr and John Wheeler, and I ended up with a book about Everett, which is provocatively titled, you know, The Many Worlds of Hugh Everett III, Multiple Universes, Mutual Assured Destruction, and the Meltdown of a Nuclear Family, which maybe I'll make a presentation on that at another point. But it led to a National Science Foundation grant, and the publication of this book, The Collected Works of Everett, with a person who's a real scientist at UC Irvine, Jeff Barrett. Much more subdued, less paranoid kind of cover art. So that leads us to the issue of media logic and what is it. In 1964, in Harper's Magazine, Richard Hofstadter observed, "It is the use of paranoid modes of expression by more or less normal people that makes the phenomena significant. Style has more to do with the way in which ideas are believed than with the truth or falsity of their content." Now, I must add that I once swore to never read out loud from PowerPoint slides, but I've learned in academia that one must be wary of saying anything that other people have not already said. In journalism, we call that churning the quote mill. We find people who will say what you want them to say so that the journalistic spin you put into a story benefits from their expert credibility. Face it, nobody cares what a reporter thinks about physics or biology, which is why we go to the quote mill to find someone who agrees with our take. And the more certain the quote, the better. By way of contrast to the paranoid style, I submit this cover of Science. While I'm personally attracted to it, I doubt that most non-scientists would give it a second glance. Here is the paranoid style in full flourish via New Scientist magazine. Sacrifice Einstein. That's always a popular topic. Einstein was wrong, right? Prepare to feel the foundations of physics shift in the cover story this week. Of course, you read it and nothing changed. But then, if you don't believe in that, you can go to the Arctic with an oil company and have the time of a lifetime. And if that doesn't thrill you, you can go witness some squids copulate. So, story promotion that put out by New Scientist here is not only engineered to grab your subscription money; it is constructed around search engine optimization or SEO techniques that cater to the paranoid style. I must note that while excellent science writing abounds in books and journals and some magazines, the subject of this talk is mainstream print and online media, not television, which takes its science cues from the leading print brands, led by the New York Times, which favors a style of, shall we say, subdued paranoia. Prepare to die as the Earth crashes through dark matter walls. Oops, maybe not, as we find out by the fourth paragraph. So far, nothing is found. As an example of how SEO works, let's look at a very restrained press release by Indiana University regarding some important research done by our very own James Glazier. It even goes so far as to say that the research is amazing. But the relatively staid release got almost zero traction on the web. So the PR folks at Indiana U came up with a paranoid lead, which also happened to be true. Sloppy shipping of human retina, donated human retina, inadvertently detected millions of dollars. And it did very well in cyberspace, increasing the story's exposure by a factor of 30. Note the targeted advertisement for freight shipping. IBM is very good at search engine optimization. No surprise there. A few days ago, I put out a press release complete with videos, photographs, and pre-selected quotes from IBM researchers about their new antiseptic. And they attached "fight superbugs" was the key to the story going viral in the paranoid medium. Sky News invented a new headline and condensed the press release, publishing it as an independent news story. "Designs gel to blow up hospital superbugs." Woman is 63 but looks 27. Frenzy over new diet pill. This might actually get you somewhere. Laptops as low as 2781. A large circulation multinational newspaper chain used the bomb metaphor twice in one headline, tacked on its own byline, and republished the press release as if it was an independent news story without bothering to verify anything. Discover Magazine went even further. Superbugs like popped balloons. But one magazine actually did some real reporting. Business Insider is no stranger to provocative headlines and product placement. But remarkably, this reporter did not treat the big blue scientists as gods. Maybe she's a Mac user. Regardless, she asked an expert who does not work for IBM to examine the superbug claim, and he said, they do not give any evidence that it works. Consequently, Business Insider reported IBM's claim as a claim subject to verification and identified the source of the claim as a corporate press release. This brings us to the essence of media logic. Framing. Public Understanding of Science is an academic journal. Although its research reports are somewhat obscured by postmodernist prose, it really does dig deep into how science and the media interact, and here it asks an important question. Have the narratives and knowledge of journalists taken over from those of scientists because of increasing media logic, defined as using storytelling techniques such as simplification, personification, polarization, intensification, concretation, stereotyping, and enhancement? Sadly, the journal's publishers failed to think through the logic of the journal's inevitable acronym. In a related article, PUS researchers noted, one reason media coverage of science is often inconsistent is that a significant portion of stories focus on creating controversy or conflict in a battle to control framing of the issue. But here's the punchline. But uncertainty is central to science and pervades almost all scientific activities. Though scientists often try to thread uncertainty into their discourse, this information is systematically removed as scientific discovery is prepared for public consumption. Specifically, news coverage of science often omits caveats and limitations stated in the original research report because this material has been streamlined, initially by scientists and then by public relations professionals and journalists. In our studies, 43% of front page newspaper stories about science were based on preliminary evidence. Of those stories, only 18% were described as preliminary or mentioned limitations of the research. Based on her research, Plesner said, journalists are not only positioned by others as representatives of the media machinery and its media logic, but they also position themselves as defenders of this media logic that people supposedly have to play along with if they want media coverage. There is an opposition between the ways in which you communicate within journalism and the ways in which scientists want to communicate certain types of research. Journalists need clear statements. They work with a lot of oppositions, black, white, new, old, knowledge, heroes, villains. They always talk about stories. They want to create stories out of everything. That makes them happy. And if you insist that the world cannot be understood as a singular phenomena and in terms of dualistic oppositions, then you are in opposition to journalists who have a criteria for success, which is to communicate in simple language. Possibly, I must add, in paranoid language. Plesner concluded, we need to be able to understand scientists from their own perspective. We need to examine the values scientists subscribe to in their activities, the source of these values, and the relationship that scientists have to others involved in similar enterprises. And this brings us to the topic of uncertainty. While too much uncertainty in reporting results can negatively impact the public's trust of scientists and reporters, recent media studies show that when limitations negatively affecting the conclusions proposed by researchers are disclosed, quote, participants rated scientists and journalists as more trustworthy. This finding is consistent with the idea that the scientific community distinguishes and ultimately sustains itself by embracing uncertainty. Uncertainty, of course, is a two-edged sword. Tobacco, sugar, and fossil fuel industry public relations professionals have expertly undermined scientific consensus on probable causations by injecting false uncertainties into the public debate. However, we can't blame the journalists for everything. Scientists have to take responsibility for how their results are communicated, at least initially. This is a study that came out recently about how randomized studies, the press releases that announce them are usually spin. spun based on what it says in the conclusion. Spin was identified in about half the press releases and media coverage. In multivariable analysis, the main factor associated with spin in press releases was the presence of spin in the article abstract conclusions. So we've got a feedback loop going on here. The more that journalists tell you to spin things out, the more the spin affects the categorization of the research. Journalists, however, must not mirror but investigate scientific claims in depth, my opinion. Or they have no business writing about science. As this recent meta-study of breast cancer trials reports, spin and bias exist in a high proportion of published studies of clinical phase two trials, and the reports focused on other less important outcomes in order to influence positively the interpretation of the results. And the authors of the study call for authors, journalists, and experts to review the articles for journals to be more rigorous in encouraging unbiased reporting of trial results and in enforcing guidelines. The eagerness of journalists and editors and publishers to embrace spin can lead to planet-circling distortions that vastly decrease the public's trust of science. Moriguchi's false claim recently about his stem cell research was published as true on the front page of the world's largest circulation daily, sans any investigation. And when the story hit the internet, within minutes, it was instantly discredited. Time magazine reported the Higgs boson as person of the year, and the nomination itself was riddled with errors, as pointed out by Michael Moyer at Scientific American and also our own Faye Flam at the Knight Science Tracker. Among other patently obvious errors, Time claimed that three researchers had found the so-called God particle, and that finding it confirmed Einstein's theory of general relativity because the particle, quote, causes energy to make the jump to matter. Unfortunately, the ability of Americans to comprehend non-paranoid science is limited. Here's some facts. Staring at television and computer and phone screens retards the myelination of the prefrontal lobes of children, diminishing their intellectual capacities. Adults too. About 40% of U.S. residents are defined as functionally illiterate. They either cannot read or write at all or have trouble filling out simple job applications. 46% of Americans believe in creationism. 19% of U.S. adults have a high level of literacy. But a high level of literacy is not always an advantage. This is popular philosopher Thomas Nagel's newest bestseller, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. And it's popular, and it's selling. People believe it. There are biological and psychological explanations of why people experience difficulty in distinguishing statements of fact from statements of belief. More facts. Multiple studies show that when facts contradict important beliefs, the facts lose. Working memory has a decay rate of less than 1 millisecond. Repetition and contextualization are vital to forming lasting memories of facts that can be believed. The perceived credibility of the source of a factual statement is essential to forming and retaining a belief. Emotional states tied to urgency and paranoia underpin entire systems of belief. Ideology can be a function of hormonal activity. For a century, public relations professionals have well understood how foundational beliefs about scientific facts can be manipulated by appeal to the emotions, especially fear. See, tobacco, climate change, weapons of mass destruction, death panels. Unfortunately, when information that is scientifically sound is introduced by the mass media, naysayers will segregate in tight-knit networks. Experts remain dispersed in the community. Not dispersed. and do not develop tight networks to oppose inaccurate information. So the question is, can science combat paranoia with more paranoia? Is it possible to counter the public relations ploys broadcast by Murdoch's News Corporation and its doppelgangers with better search engine optimization? I think not. Something else is needed to address the problem of cognitive bias. And much of that has to do with journalists dedicating ourselves to doing our homework and introducing the concept of uncertainty to the public at large. The list of cognitive biases is legion. However, many mainstream journalists and editors seek to amplify the biases already embedded within scientific presentations. In fact, we look for those biases. We like them. They make headlines. Scientists and journalists alike must stop playing this shell game. Stakes are huge. Part of the problem is that millions of Americans are just downright ignorant about what science is and what science does. In his illuminating book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, author Joe Badgent explains how Fox News watchers think to his liberal friends. Creationism is easy to understand and supports their resentment of egghead scientists who are too damn smart-ass anyway. Many fundamentalists who I know personally are kind, brave, hardworking people. The very nature of liberalism, with its emphasis on diversity and individuality, makes it hard to organize millions of Americans to accept scientific fact. Besides learning more about the religious right, we need to learn how to talk about them calmly and thoughtfully. We need to help people distinguish between knowledge and opinions, between hype and the tools of scientific uncertainty. Regarding censorship, it's hard to quantify, but it's clearly tied to the preservation of advertising revenue and political agendas. Anybody who wants personal examples, talk to me after the recorded meeting. For example, you have to search far and wide for hard-hitting stories exposing the pharmaceutical and chemical industries, the military-industrial academic complex, the Gates Foundation, and Pink Ink. The list goes on. So let's sum up the problem.
What is Pink Ink?
That's the nonprofit mammogram positive industry, shall we say. Reaction belief perseverance is defined as maintaining a belief in the face of overwhelming data that contradicts the beliefs. Correcting misinformation is not as simple as presenting people with true facts. By the way, did you know that the New York Times just closed its Environmental Bureau, which was created in 2009 to investigate climate and pollution issues? The desk's 7 reporters and 2 editors are being assigned to other beats. Times officials claim that the liquidation of the Bureau will not affect its environmental reporting. And we'll put up the screen and go to the blackboard and see what you guys have by way of solutions. Well, I think that I did actually make the one suggestion that I can put my head around, which is that journalists need to do a better job, and scientists need to not really listen so much to the public. A lot of journalists lost their jobs in the past 5 years and went and became public relations specialists, which is kind of like, you know, for those of us who are still journalists, I would hate to have that happen because you can't come back to the other direction, you know. Nonetheless, it means that the public relations specialists are really good at what they do now. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't be listened to, and I'm not saying that a lot of them aren't really good at what they do and conducting a valuable service, but I think the scientists should be a little bit skeptical about how their research is spun out, because the tendency, as these studies show, is to remove any suggestions of uncertainty. And, you know, frankly, you know, my understanding of science is that it seldom really is certain. It's a progression towards, you know, tracking the truth as we know it, you know. And the truth of one era is the mistake of another. Yes?
It's sort of interesting, but in some ways what you're saying about this making things look as if they're certain is the opposite of what one often sees with political coverage, where one will see on the one hand, on the one side says this, the other side said this, and then you look at the rest of the article, and there are clearly facts that say that one side is right.
Well, see, this brings, yeah.
Somehow seems to be a very different way of.
Well, that brings us to the question of false balance, which is gradually being addressed, you know, not just in science, but in political reporting, where it's particularly virulent. You know, for a long time around climate change and even evolution, you know, reporters and their editors especially have said, well, you've got the opinion of this one expert, now go get the diametrically opposed opinion. Well, why should you? Don't do it. You know, it's either raining or it's not raining. You know, we're under no obligation to give crackpots their day. Hi, James.
I'm trying to understand what the problem is. The problem is, in your view, that people are presenting scientific uncertainty reframed as conflict, which it's not.
Yes, very good. Very good. Yeah. And it plays into this, what I label the paranoid style that sells newspapers and magazines, you know, because people lack the educational tools to understand the true role of uncertainty.
What about magazines like Nature.com, which seem, at least in some cases, to bend right in the direction that you're complaining about? And indeed, those policies led to Hendrik Schoen having 6 or 7 Nature articles and a similar number of science articles without fact-checking, overriding some referees that were worried. I wonder if the scientists aren't equally guilty of typing their work and then the editors just play along.
Well, that's the point that I was trying to make in the presentation. In fact, I think that, I don't know if the scientists are equally guilty, but it's a slippery slope. Once you start working towards search engine optimization and the other tools of public relations, then how far does it take you to outright fraud? You know, so it's not just the journalists have to clean up our act. Scientists got to clean it up too. You know.
Well, the problem is Nature is not run by scientists.
Yeah, and it has advertisements. And you know what? Getting an article that or an investigation that might be critical of say the breast cancer industry is almost impossible to do in Nature or Science or well, maybe not Science, but Scientific American. There's just some things that there's hands off because their advertising budgets are in the billions of dollars. And magazine publishers will not go out, will not print stuff that's, you know, truly critical of them. It hits the nail on the head. Hey.
I wondered if you think that there's recently been a real blurring between press releases, you know, PR material, and journalism. I've been surprised at recently giving talks for undergraduate classes where the students don't really know the difference between a journalistic story and a press release.
Yeah, it's a problem. I went to talk to a journalism class at Sonoma State University not too long ago, and it was a journalism class, right? And I said before I started, how many of you want to be investigative reporters? And like one guy in the back put up his hand, right? And then I said, how many of you want to go into public relations? And everybody put up their hands. So I said, you know what? All you people that want to go into public relations, you're not going to have a job unless at least half of you go into investigative reporting.
So if the press tends to get the details of what scientists do wrong, how do you feel about, I don't know, a burden being put on scientists to say blog and just talk to the public about what they're doing? How much of this problem do you think exists because scientists generally do their work in an ivory tower locked away from the public?
I think that the more transparency in the process, the better, you know. And somebody might say, well, if scientists blog, then, you know, the Fox News people might pick up on some, you know, innocent statement and magnify it into something, and it's not. And that's true, but, you know, that's going to happen anyways with some statistical probability. I mean, look at the ClimateGate, you know, email things. I mean, that was almost innocuous, and yet they put ClimateGate on it immediately. They framed it as Watergate, you know. And my personal opinion is that the more the better, you know. I mean, people can't walk in fear. And if people are going to misinterpret what scientists say, well, they will. But they've been doing that since, you know, Copernicus and long before, you know. So my personal feeling is that people should talk to the public as much as possible and not be afraid to talk to religious people or reactionary people. And I seriously recommend that book, Deer Hunting with Jesus, because it's pretty remarkable. You end up with some true understanding and compassion for the white working class people in Virginia that he's talking about, who number in the tens of millions in this country, and who are actually been convinced by the media that the very forces that are undermining their own economic stability are the forces that they should support. You know, so the only way to undo that, I think, is by people genuinely engaging in dialogue. Okay?
So, do you think the onus should be on people who are already well known? Because it's very hard for ordinary scientists to become visible in the community of ordinary people. Do you think it should be people like Brian Greene, for example, who have successfully written about science and who are well read, or Nobel laureates who should? What is the forum in which such ideas can be discussed, which will impact the public?
I think there's all different levels. I mean, obviously, people that have a high public profiles, you know, from Stephen Hawking to, you know, Brian to, you know, any number of other people, in my opinion, should not fear stating their how they really feel about stuff.
Do you think people like Richard Dawkins have made any difference at all? Because there's always contrary.
Oh,
this guy. And this is because science is never certain. But so many things that he says are controversial and people discuss it. But then the public takes it as, oh, yeah, well, it's both two sides to the story and this guy is just another opinion.
Well, you know, our tendency is to want to be reductionist when looking at the media as well as, aspects of science, physics, and evolutionary biology, too. And the Dawkins thing, I don't think, can be reduced to a soundbite. You know, I mean, he's made important contributions as a scientist, and his writings about religion have actually really stirred up the argument a lot. You know, it's like Zero Dark Thirty, right? I mean, it put torture onto the public table, you know, and then they started to shoot the messengers. They're always going to shoot the messengers. But it's a question of courage for scientists and journalists.
What do you think about the opportunities of these massive online courses?
I personally like them when they're talking about, like, Khan University, for instance. I take their little linear algebra courses and things like that, you know. I stay away from their sociology. The problem with that, of course, is that the UC Regents would like to pretty much privatize and turn the whole university system into an online course, you know. And you can't do that with nursing, you can't do that with auto mechanics, and you can't do it with physics and philosophy and English and you name it, you know. But there's a role for it, in my opinion. You know, it's positive. Especially, you know, given the reality of education in this country, poor people are getting the shaft. Does that mean they shouldn't have any education at all? You know, if it's going to be online, okay, it's going to be online to a degree. You know, but we shouldn't roll over and let the Regents put University of California online.
You mentioned the advertising push. So the one, you know, in terms of driving a lot of the editors use potentially what they will and won't allow journalists to do who's working for them on payroll. But this whole financial model has changed so much in the last 10 years just because of the, you know, blogging. Papers, you know, as you said, the New York Times is currently reducing staff. Those probably aren't becoming science reporters either.
No, crime reporters, maybe.
So, you know, part of the question is what is the financial model, you know, that anybody sees that allows for independent scientific journalism?
Okay, I've actually thought about this, and back in 1929, Upton Sinclair. You know, he did a lot of good investigative reporting, the jungle and stuff like that. Wrote a book called The Brass Check, where he investigated journalism, the New York Times, Herald Tribune. And basically, he called it The Brass Check because in those days, when you went into a house of ill repute, you paid your money downstairs and they gave you a little brass token to take upstairs. And that was his opinion of journalists. It didn't help him when he ran for governor of California. But he hit the nail on the head, which was that advertising corrupts journalism. Now, our model of journalism has been based on advertising forever in this country, you know, and obviously a lot of good journalism has been done, and I submit that despite that model, you know. but it doesn't work anymore. What happened when the internet came along was all these newspaper publishers saw a golden opportunity to get rid of their major costs, which was newsprint and then reporters, because they could use this content across all these little platforms that they developed, right? And they shot themselves in the foot because they gave it away for free. And now nobody wants to pay for a newspaper article because it's not worth anything. But there are plenty of people publishing information in journals, proprietary type journals, mostly financial journals, but some scientific journals, that people subscribe to and pay like thousands of dollars a year for. I think there's a real niche for that in terms of investigative reporting and science writing for the masses. I think people obviously will pay for information that is valuable to them. Right now, people pay several hundred dollars a year to have these daily newspapers put 5 pounds of ads on their doorstep, you know, every week with minimal content, you know. People need information, they want information. Investigative reporting gives us information, science gives us information. The two are really tied together in my head. And so, using the internet as a medium to get people to, say, subscribe to a hybrid internet online print journal of science of some sort, or investigative journalism, has been working more and more. People do not like to read long-form journalism online. It hurts the eyes, and they don't like to read complicated science stories online. You want to sit down and look at it and mark it and come back to it, you know? And a lot of people throughout the world don't have computers, you know? So print's not dead, you know? There was a big recent study of the transformation of the past few years done by Reuters, of all people. It's like 200 pages, I just read it. And the main takeaways are that the profitability of journalistic corporations prior to the meltdown was 20% return every year. It's hugely one of the most profitable industries in the world. And now it's 6%. You know, you can take that to the bank. I mean, how much are you getting on your 401k, you know? So journalism is not being eviscerated because you can't make any money doing it. It's being eviscerated because the lower your production cost, the more your profit, and the more, you know, you reduce the capacity of the reading or television watching public to digest and separate knowledge from opinion, you know, the easier it is to sell this crap, you know, in the newspapers. The other thing is that, as this study pointed out, when you look online, it's like 95% of the news is still generated by the legacy news organizations, you know, which is the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and others, you know. So we need, you know, I'm all in favor of daily newspapers being buried, you know. They're a waste of time, in my opinion. And the sooner that they die, you know, the more fertile the ground is for new grassroots organizations to come up that utilize the internet as a medium to get information out. But there is some information they can get, which they can either then get online or they can, you know, get through the mail. People over 50 still subscribe to newsletters and, you know, journals and things like that.
So I remember a few years ago there being efforts, or maybe even some organizations started, funded by foundations to, I think it was by foundations, to have professionally done science journalists to support them, who would then, you know, feed out the articles to the media. I don't remember hearing anything about it recently, and I wondered if there have been concerted efforts to try to tap some of the recently minted billionaires who worked with science and engineering backgrounds, which there are quite a few.
Well, you know, like places like the Knight Science Foundation, which was based on the Knight Ritter newspaper fortune, been doing pretty good stuff in terms of funding new approaches to journalism and stuff. But there's this another school of thought which believes that journalism should be turned over to billionaire philanthropists. And it's been done a few times. You know, ProPublica, which is a very good investigative online news site, it's won a bunch of prizes and it's done some good work, although it fails to go for the juggler, usually, in my opinion. It was financed by the billionaires that sold Golden West Financial right before the collapse of 2008. And, you know, basically, if they'd waited a year, it would have been worth 2 cents. They sold it for like $10 billion, and so now they give ProPublica like $10 million a year, and they hired a former editor of the Wall Street Journal to run it. So consequently, when you read stories there, they'll talk about bad things that have happened with contractors that misplaced government money, but they won't tell you who the contractor is. It's infuriating. And then in San Francisco, Warren Hellman, who was a junk bond specialist, basically, let's not mince words, started the Bay Citizen, which basically is dedicated to what I call what's a very pedestrian type of reporting. You know, it's process-oriented reporting. It never really goes through the investigations and stuff. And it would never, ever touch anything that impacted Mr. Hellman's business interests, you know. See, and then in Texas, guess who bought the Texas Tribune? T-Bone Pickens, the oil billionaire arbitrager, you know. So that's been happening in a number of places. And then a lot of the nonprofit journalist types of organizations, like the Sunlight Foundation. That's a great title, the Sunlight Foundation, based on Justice Brandeis's dictum that sunlight is the best disinfectant, you know. It's gotten really big. It gives grants to some journalists. It jumpstarts a lot of Web 2.0 type, you know, mapping organizations that can tell you who gave what political contribution to what candidate. Like, really, I don't care that much about that sort of thing because it's really trivial. Who founded it? I mean, the reporters all love the Sunlight Foundation. They want to get money from the Sunlight Foundation. They don't ask who founded it. Well, I actually found out, and I actually wrote an article about it. It was founded by a man named Michael Klein, who's on the board of directors of SRA International, which is the second largest recipient of CIA consultant contracts, and is basically made his fortune in the military weapons manufacturing industries, you know. So when you tell a reporter that, they're like, oh shit, you know.
Two more questions, and we'll wrap
up. It's interesting to me because you started out with something which was a rather narrow issue, which was taking scientific uncertainty and having it respawn in the form of conflict. And yes, the examples you're presenting now are all conflict-oriented examples.
Yeah.
I think there are journalists like Gleick or Ball who do actually a very good job in what I guess you'd have to call now a semi-popular mode, mm-hmm. of presenting science with uncertainty in long form.
Yeah, there are.
Now, then we're coming back to something which is really more of a news-oriented scientific presentation. And you're talking about that specifically investigative journalism in the idea of exposing issues, which is a little different from where we started, which was presentation of science.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just trying to understand the relationship between the issues that you're addressing. They're all important, but they're somewhat different questions.
Well, I think that, you know, life is full of unities of opposites, and in my case, I'm torn, you know, because I really do believe that uncertainty needs to be presented by journalists and writers in such a way that the general public understands what it means in terms of science. And the guys you mentioned do a wonderful job. There are a lot of good science writers out there. Faye's a good science writer, you know. I was hitting on the most egregious examples of hype because they're what the mainstream people see. Most people don't read James Glick, you know, but they do read Fox News and stuff like that. And my concern is not with the intellectuals that read, you know, chaos and the information, you know. My concern is with the people that are watching television, because those are people who are going to kind of decide what happens in this country for the next period of time.
What do you think of futurity?
Futurism?
No, futurity, the new science news site that picks up, that's trying to address this issue by picking up press releases from universities. Are you unaware of that?
I'm unaware of it. I'm aware of a place called The Conversation, which picks up press releases and then disseminates them.
There's a site that's called futurity.org that picks up scientific press releases from big universities and interprets them somewhat, but puts out stuff that's actually very, very, I think, very
well done. They send out an, you can go to the site, you can subscribe to an email and get 5 or 6 articles every day.
Well, I'm not aware of that, but it sounds like it's probably a good thing. And I want to be clear that in my presentation, I deliberately set out to be provocative because I think we have a real problem here, you know, and I don't want to skirt around the issue. And we need to it's not going to be solved by, you know, some public policy statement. It's only going to be solved on the ground by reporters and scientists, you know, one day at a time, you know, having the courage to say what they think is true.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you, Peter.